Is he the voice of the opposition? Good Monday morning and live from Studio 5. This is First Coast Connect, and I'm Melissa Ross. Thanks for listening. Just to add this hour, new city councilman Matt Carlucci is already striking an independent tone on the city's biggest issues. This morning, he takes your calls. Join us. It's 549-2937. Give us a call. Then later, Culpepper on the start of Jag's training camp. All of that and more just ahead this morning. But first this hour, from the fate of the Jacksonville Landing to how we pay for school improvements and more, new city councilman Matt Carlucci isn't afraid of opposing the will of Mayor Lenny Curry's administration. He joins us now in studio with more about his biggest priorities and takes your calls. Councilman Carlucci, good morning. Thanks for being with us.
Good morning. Great to be here.
Good to have you on the show. And what are your questions for Jacksonville City Councilman Matt Carlucci? It's 549-2937. That's 549-2937. Or go online. Send your emails to firstcoastconnect@wjct.org and tweets to @MelissaInJax. All right, let's get right to it, Councilman. The Duval County School Board says it's going to seek outside legal counsel after the City Council, two committees, have voted to prevent the school officials from holding a referendum this year on a half-cent sales tax for schools. You and your colleague Joyce Morgan were votes of opposition. You voted against deferring this referendum legislation, but you were in the minority. Why?
Because my conscience will not allow me to put this referendum off to 2020. The first money to be spent on these, the first dollars to be spent on this from this referendum are going to be on safety and security of our schools. That's our children. And I ran on a pledge of looking after the future generations, and I'm going to put that off a year. I mean, it is even some of our nicest schools. There's so many different ways to access inside those schools, and so. I just absolutely cannot bring myself to allow myself to put something like that off. And in addition, all our role is, as in the city council, is to just let the people vote. That's it. If you look at the referendum, too, it explains this money is for security, safety, building new schools, remodeling and bringing up new schools. In other words, bringing our school system into the 21st century. And there's money there for charters. So I don't want to get into a pitting charter versus traditional public schools, but there's no doubt about it. The traditional public schools are the ones that are in the most need of repair or having new schools.
It's 549-2937. We'll go to your calls for Councilman Matt Carlucci in a moment. Last week, school board member Warren Jones said he believes the school district is being held hostage by charter school operators who are pushing for hundreds of millions of dollars off the top from a sales tax. Do you agree or disagree with that?
Warren Jones is one of my great, has been a great mentor to me. So I do think that there is a charter school agenda in the mix. And I think that they want money on a different type basis than what a sales tax would allow. So the charter schools want money based on a per pupil basis. You can't do that with a sales tax unless somebody tells me how you do. Sales tax money is for capital outlay, capital construction cost. So you can't use it for operational or for expanding charter schools. Now, if charter schools need money, and charter schools are an important part of our total public school system, if they need more money, then let's find a way to get them more money, because those are children as well. But they are
what
already.
What would be that way?
Well, I talked to our city council auditor, Kyle Billy, and he didn't come up in any specific ways, but he said there are certain things that we could do a bond issue on, dollars that might be available for a bond issue. But the sales tax is simply for bringing our older schools up into the 21st century. And it's going to take every nickel of the money it raises to do that. And if we put it off another year, it's going to be more expensive.
It looks as though that's what's going to happen, though. Your opinion is a minority opinion, it seems, on the city council. You're also one of the only Republicans on the city council to not vote in lockstep with the mayor's priorities. Why is that?
Because I don't consider Republican, Democrat, or partisan politics. I don't think that plays a role in local government. I think people in future generations, our children, that's what plays the role in my mind. When I'm thinking about an issue, I'm thinking down the road. I'm not thinking Republican, Democrat. I that's just not in my DNA. Now, maybe if I was in the House of Representatives or Congress, maybe a little more partisanship might play into it, but not on the local level. So I'm not against Lenny Curry. I think Lenny Curry legitimately cares, I really do, about our children. I have no doubt about that. And so I don't want to turn a discussion about schools into a this, into pitting one against the other, be it a politician, be it politicians, or be it the civic council, or be it our mayor. But to me, the charter of the city of Jacksonville doesn't say one word about schools when it comes to the city council section in the charter, nor in the mayor's. So you go to the school board section, that's who is in charge of improving our schools, not the city council.
Do you feel that the Office of General Counsel at City Hall has improperly intervened in this when he issued an opinion, a legal opinion, that has forced the school board to go to all of you on the city council?
Well, I think his opinion opened the door for the council members to ask a whole lot of questions about the issue. And then what bothers me, because I have great respect for my colleagues. They're very smart. They're sharp, and Lord knows I don't doubt their noble causes. But when you're in committee and the superintendent is in committee along with her administration and school board members, they are there to answer questions. And then when it gets deferred, it's because all these council members have all these questions. And so I'm thinking, well, this is where you get your information, because we're in committee. This is committee work. But nobody asked the superintendent to come up and answer any of these questions. So I've been working on this issue 2 months before the election because I knew it would be coming along, and I wanted to make myself a better candidate and, if elected, a better councilman. And so I have availed myself to 4 or 5 other town meetings, one just the other night at Beaches Watch, where their school board member, Elizabeth Anderson, did a great job, an amazing job of explaining this. And so all of these questions and this and that and the other, I think, has had a way of stalling this.
And at the same time, this is playing out in Duval County. In Clay County, the school board there says it's going to sue after the Clay County Commission did a similar thing, forestalled the Clay County School Board from putting a measure before the voters in that county to decide up or down on a sales tax referendum to pay for school construction and repair. The school board here says it's going to seek outside counsel. Do you think they should do what the Clay County School Board has done and file suit over this matter?
Well, I think that the school board is exasperated. I think Diana Green, who is, by the way, this has been talked about for 15 years to do these improvements, and she's the first one to step up and say, let's put it on the ballot. It's our first lady African-American superintendent, and she has been bold enough to bring it before the council. Regardless of Jason Gabriel and the general counsel, and I have a lot of respect for Jason. I worked with him when he was with Alvin Brown's administration. Mm-hmm. Put his opinion aside. It's, to me, still only one question of council members, whether we want the people to vote or not.
But do you think that the Duval School Board should take a leaf out of Clay County's playbook and do the same thing, try to file a lawsuit over this matter, even though technically they're not allowed to do that?
Well, you know what? sometimes you've got to find a, I was going to say find another way to skin a cat, but I don't offend any cat lovers out there.
So that sounds like a yes. It sounds like you think they should do that.
I think they need to do whatever's possible to make our schools safe for our children, period, and as soon as possible.
So you think they should sue?
Well, maybe get a court opinion. I don't know, you know, about suing. I don't ever like to use the word sue, but I think if it takes a court opinion to determine what they think, then maybe everybody gets satisfied from there. But I think at the very least, the council, we should have taken this up, put it on the ballot, let the people vote, do away with the drama, and get back to doing the work we're supposed to be doing.
All right, let's go to some calls now for Matt Carlucci. It's 549-2937. Mark is in Mandarin. Hi, Mark. Good morning.
Hi. I'd like to ask the councilman if this council in discussing the sales tax issue considered a property tax. I worked in Texas and dealt with property taxes in two different counties, and both counties had multiple school taxes on each bill. And there were three advantages to that over sales tax. One is, in the sales tax, you have a problem with border businesses losing revenues because people and businesses shop across the border to save on the sales tax. Also, the sales tax is regressive. It's paid by poor people as well. Whereas property taxes are only paid by businesses and individuals who can afford property. And finally, sales taxes, although they always are said to initially be temporary, wind up being permanent because after a number of years, when the buildings of the schools and whatnot are built, the government always says, okay, people are used to paying the sales tax, let's use these revenues for something else.
All right, Mark, thanks for all those points.
Well, in ad valorem taxes, he may have said this. He listed so many good reasons why you could use the millage is deductible from taxes.
But no mayor has wanted to take on that political third rail.
Well, here's the thing about that: the city didn't decide which way to go. The school board said they wanted to do a sales tax, and so I could list a lot of advantages to a sales tax, which economic times are very good. So sales taxes are coming in. Very well. The people from out of town would be helping to pay it. I don't disagree with the gentleman there, but if I had it my way, I would like to see perhaps let's get the sales tax behind us and then let's do a referendum with millage for a raise for teachers, because that's the only way you can give teachers a raise is through a millage increase. And it wouldn't take an entire mill to give school teachers the raise they deserve.
How much of a raise do you think they should get?
Well, I think they ought to get a decent one. I'm not sure exactly how much they make. My daughter was a teacher for a while, and I think she made somewhere in the 30s, you know, as a beginning teacher. But I think school raises are hard to come by because the whole finances of the school system are so tight. So I would, if we want to just say, hey, let's take care of our education, then let's do a sales tax for the improvements, and then come back maybe a year later and see if the people want to give them a raise with a millage.
You also, let me also point out that you recently wrote a handwritten letter to a student at Fishwer Elementary School.
Yes.
Laying out your positions about why you believe the sales tax for schools needs to go forward this year. This got picked up and shared on social media. Is this something you plan to make a habit out of, writing letters to
constituents? I write letters all the time. And I get accused of writing in cursive, which...
Yeah, I kind of wondered if she even could read your cursive writing, because kids today don't get taught cursive writing.
They don't, but this is obviously a very smart young lady. But what she says in her letter is just heart tugging. He says, my parents, and she said, this year my school will be 103 years old. It is a wonderful school. I feel upset that it doesn't get any funding. There are about five classrooms that these beams are holding up the roof. My parents taught me to leave things better than they were originally, she said, adding that the tax would help all students attend a school that would be better than when it started. Respectfully, I would ask, what are you doing to lead these schools better, you know. And she didn't get any replies except from the mayor. The mayor replied to her, but she didn't get any other replies. And so I told my wife, I said, it's going to be my first act of business. First thing I do, I'm going to handwrite that little girl a note, and I'm going to make it positive. Because every kid's first experience in government should be a positive one. And so I just told her so many words, don't worry, to you and your schoolmates, help's on the way.
It's 549-2937. Lots of calls now for City Councilman Matt Carlucci. Isla Ray is in Riverside. Isla Ray, good morning.
Good morning. Good morning. I just want to thank Mr. Carlucci for his work with this particular issue. I was very impressed at the committee meeting where he stated, or where he asked the other members why they were not asking a question or their questions, directing their questions to the superintendent and school board members who attended. He was putting, making it a real issue, and I appreciate even now as he speaks with you that he is focusing on the issue and not on personalities and not on speculation. Thank you, Mr. Carlucci.
You're very welcome.
549-2937. Carla is on the west side. Hi, Carla. Good morning.
Good morning.
Hey, go ahead.
Yes, I was just wanting to ask if he, not to speak for anybody, you know.
If you, hey, Carla, mind. Get off. Are you on speakerphone?
I'm on a Bluetooth.
Okay, if you could get off that would be good.
Can you hear me?
Yeah, that's a little better. Go ahead.
Yeah, so I didn't want to ask him to read anyone's mind, but I did want to inquire if he has any idea why the other council members who are interested in this aren't speaking out more publicly. Like, why do they just kind of hedge and stay silent?
Okay, thank you for that question. You have taken a position on this that's a minority position, it seems, on the Jacksonville City Council. What about your colleagues?
I'm not going to speak for my colleagues. By the way, we're
trying to get more new council members on the show.
It wouldn't be fair. I think they have noble reasons why, but I, you know, just speaking for myself, we have a chance to make history here, and I don't understand why so few people seem to know that. When a big company comes to Jacksonville, they want to bring a big company, and that would develop a lot of jobs, which we need desperately in the city, new, good-paying jobs. Two questions they ask. How safe is your city? How good is your education system? And I got to tell you, we're not doing so well in those two areas right now, at least on with the murder rate. There's a lot of other parts of Jacksonville that are safe. Yeah. And I think Mike Williams is doing the best job that he can. So, and he gets support. Well, we need to give the same support to Diana Greene. And as my good friend Warren Jones, he got up and said the other night, I didn't address that, but I think he was exasperated. He's been on the council 28 years. He's heard it all. So he just called him out. So, you know, good for him. I might have done the same thing.
It sounds kind of to me like you've been doing that on this program today. Is it because you are at large that you feel liberated to say what you think, take an independent tack, be the voice of the opposition? Nobody can, you know, threaten you with loss of funds and projects to a certain district, say?
Well, I think I'm trying to take a lead in the proposition, and that is to pass it.
That didn't answer my question,
okay,
though.
Okay, so go ahead. What was the question again?
Do you feel emboldened to be very vocal about this and other issues, like the Jacksonville Landing, for example, which we'll get to in a moment, because you're at large? You were elected citywide. Nobody can hold over your head any kind of leverage to hurt your district if you don't line.
I think I feel emboldened because I'm passionate about these issues. I'm 63 years old, and I have a window here, and I want to use it to the best of my ability. I don't want to poke anybody in the eye, but when I get elected, you know, I don't leave my First Amendment at the door. I bring it with me like I have before I was on the council. So I'm trying to promote good things for Jacksonville as I see them, And if they're not good things, then maybe somebody's got a better idea. Hey, that's fine. Listen, one time me and Jim Tullis years ago, my good friend, God bless him, he could be the toughest fighter in the world. And he and I were fighting about an issue on the council. Finally, I said, you know what, dadgummit, he's right. And he was about three chairs down from me. And I whistled over to him. I said, Jim. And I took my proposition and I tore it in half. I said, you win. So
Scott is in Jacksonville Beach. Hey, Scott, good morning. Thanks for your call.
Hey, good morning. Hey, when I moved here a few years ago, I heard a lot about the pension reform problem. And, I liked what Mayor Curry had to say about how to fix that.
Yes.
And as a Democrat, I voted for him. And I was happy that he tackled that right away. But now we're faced with this. And this seems like a way more important, bigger problem. And I'm really disappointed that he's not taking this opportunity to step up and lead from the top. And I think if he were to take that and lead and get this done, that a lot of people, including myself, might reconsider voting for him. So I hope he's listening, and I hope he takes care of this for us.
Thanks, Scott. Well, you know, he's in his final term as mayor. I'm sure he might seek higher office after this, but thank you for the call.
Well, let me say this. The mayor, the person that we need to be letting take the lead, and I say this in due respect to what he's saying, because I understand where he's coming from, Scott. But we should be supporting our superintendent. And if you're the mayor or the council members, you should be saying, how can we help you pass it? That's what we did with tolls. The council helped Tommy Hazzuri when we did away with tolls. We went out on the campaign trail helping him. That's what we did for Better Jacks. That's what a lot of people do with the pension. But he's right about, Scott is right about this. This is probably our most important issue because it has to do with getting young people educated, which will keep them hopefully out of gangs, which will hopefully help them make good decisions and building their future, building their world of tomorrow. And the only way you can really do that is if you're well educated. And we got to bring our old school system in the 21st century. And the way around on that, to me, my conscience just won't allow it.
And why do you think so many of your colleagues aren't persuaded by that argument? They have a different view.
I think some of my colleagues are very pro-charter schools. And I think the Civic Council has wanted to pin down an amount of money that they would get kind of guaranteed. And the way that they want that done is not, unless somebody can tell me differently, You can't do that with the sales tax. The sales tax is used for where the needs are for construction and capital improvements. Charter school's not that old. We got one school. This young girl who I wrote the letter to, her school's 103 years old.
Fishware.
Yeah, Fishware. There, we have another school that was built during the Spanish-American War. It's still being used. I mean, our schools aren't named after Confederate generals for nothing, okay? they're old schools.
Yeah, let's get a few more calls on the air. Elaine in Jacksonville. Hi, Elaine. Good morning.
Good morning. I just have a general question, and I don't know if it's been addressed. It's just my question is that when taxes are charged, I mean, whatever happened to lottery funds or prior tax funds that were used for that purpose, I'm okay with they have accepted the sales tax, but can we, accountability of where those funds are actually going, and that's important to me. And I'll take my answer off there.
Okay, thanks, Elaine.
Great question. There will be a Citizens Oversight Committee made up of professionals, and they will make sure the money is being spent the way it was. By the way, interesting note here. Dr. Green did two referendums in Manatee County, and they built three new schools. They're building a wing on another school, and they did some security and safety improvements. And guess what's happened down there? Public school enrollment has risen.
And do you think that is perhaps why there are some players here in Duval County who are opposed to this referendum? Maybe they would prefer to see enrollment in charter schools rise rather than in traditional public schools.
I think that question needs to be asked of them, because I don't want to get on here and get into speculation, and I just want to stick to the facts. And But I will tell you that I've asked a lot of people what they thought student enrollment would be after these improvements, and our superintendent even says, I don't know. I called down, spoke to the superintendent in Manatee County, and I said, just tell me what happened. And then at the end, I said, by the way, what happened with enrollment? And she says, enrollment went up. in charter school enrollment went down. Now, I'm not pitting one against the other, but I'm just saying, you know, sometimes parents are going to the charter schools because the older schools are so old and they need upgrading.
Here's an email from Coral. Florida spends less than $9,000 a year to educate a child, but $22,000 a year to incarcerate an inmate. We need to focus on building strong kids instead of repairing broken adults. Lots of tweets coming into the show. Here's one from a listener. Can we please stop underfunding public education? Stop saying the system is broken and then proving it. Fix the issue. Here's a tweet from it's a satirical Twitter account, Lenny Curry's Lawn. It's a reference to the Jacksonville Landing being taken down for green space. Tell Matt Carlucci that I went ahead and added his name to the volunteer list for mowing me after I'm installed. He will need to supply his own mower and gas, as we will be under tight budgetary constraints due to Lot J funding priorities. Okay, it's a joke about the Jacksonville Landing. Let me ask you about that briefly before we let you go. You were quite vocal as you came onto the city council about your opposition to what is almost certainly now going to happen. The Jacksonville Landing is going to be demolished. That's what the mayor wants. That's what other players on the council and in the business community want. Have you given up that fight?
No, I haven't given up that fight at all. We're in the middle of this school referendum, and this right now, it kind of eclipses the landing to me. But I still think that we should have public hearings. I did call the mayor's office to ask when the public hearings would be held last Friday. They said they'd get back to me. Apparently they have a plan, but they want to hear from the public. I think the biggest thing is I wish they would leave the landing as an option in that and not just tear it down and start listening to people. I have a group of young professionals I meet with on an official basis every quarter, and we talked about the landing one time. And my gosh, the ideas that they were coming up with for the landing, and that's what drove me to the DIA to say, let's have a charrette. Now, if we can get past that, that's a French word, you know, it's a public discussion about what to do with the landing. And then they say, well, we had that 5 years ago, so we don't need any more public input.
Yeah, they did something like that 5 years ago.
I don't agree. So that's not fresh public input. And when it's real that the landing is fixing to come down, then people start to get a little more serious about what they think about it.
What about the argument, though, that it's just not a viable commercial space anymore?
Well, it may not be. I'm not saying I know all, but I think it should be left in the equation. Let me just tell you, Miami, I think Sarasota and Tampa and Norfolk all had festival shopping. They readapted those buildings, and they are all now flourishing. So why not leave that as an option? I don't know why we can't leave that as an option.
Let's take one more call. It's Linda in Deerwood. Linda, good morning.
Good morning. For those who listen on Friday, my voice is still hoarse from being passionate. I would just like to ask Mr. Carlucci. I agree that we need something for the school system. I'd like to ask you, what do you want the citizens to do to help the superintendent? The school board did a great job of selecting someone they thought could move the needle, and now they're being stymied. I'd like to suggest, if we're going to be stymied because we have to use the same city council lawyer, let's have a GoFundMe hashtag so we can fund the attorney if we have to file suit against the city. Just a thought.
Well,
thank you.
Okay, thanks for that. And, you know, her call points up the fact that there's strong, widespread popular support, according to UNF's polling anyway, for this sales tax and for paying for better school buildings. That the grassroots feel on this isn't translating to the votes on city council. And so what about her question in that it's easy for constituents to say, well, the school board needs to fight this. The legal reality of that is more complicated.
Well, people usually come up with the best ideas, in my opinion, and I have found that. And so I don't know about a GoFundMe account. I think they have people that they can get the money from in order to help them if they want to challenge this, this you know, and challenge this issue so that it can be on the 2019 ballot. But it still has time to be on the 2019 ballot. It still has time. And it doesn't have to be in November. It could be in December 5th. It's not been in. So there is time, but action needs to be taken. So if there's questions out there, people on the council who have questions, legitimate questions, all you do is you call the superintendent. You can schedule time to go see her. You can schedule time to talk to the CFO, the chief financial officer, Michelle Begley, who is extremely smart and says, by the way, there are no bonding issues on this, no bonding red flags, to the city for this bond issue. Matter of fact, it's a good time to do a bond because the economy is so good, as I said earlier. By the way, back to the guy that said, would I get a lawnmower out? I do have a lawnmower. I mow my own lawn. And if that does turn out to be a lawn only and it's not kept up, I'll take my damn lawnmower out there and help, you know, mow the yard.
You, Matt Carlucci, will go mow the grass at the site of the former Jacksonville Landing.
I want my city to look good.
Okay, that brings up a related issue because that's a satirical parody Twitter account. There are plenty of those. I want to ask you as a follow-up. You recently commented on TV, and in fact, you cussed on TV.
First time ever. First time ever today on radio. Sorry.
That's okay. But you swore on television about the mayor's struggles with his constituents on social media, accusations that he bullied a private citizen on Twitter. You spoke out about that. Have you spoken to the mayor about this?
What's your relationship like with him? First of all, I didn't speak towards the mayor. I decided deliberately not to do that because I try to look at it as a holistic basis. And I said, we all need to be careful what we tweet. Because when we tweet certain things, an average citizen tweeting, it's just, you know, a comment. And then, you know, what we tweet back can sometimes intimidate.
Do you think that's what he did?
Well, I think that's the way she felt. And ironically, it was Mark Wood's wife who writes for the Times Union. And she's so dear. She is so dear. You know, this is my feeling about Twitter. I Twitter some. And my feeling is if you're going to tweet something that uplifts people, that uplifts an idea. But if you got something to say about somebody or you want to challenge somebody, then I prefer to do that in a more direct fashion.
Final question for you. As I said earlier, you were elected citywide. You're at large. You have high name recognition. You're emerging as a voice of the opposition on this current city council. When you finish your four-year term, are you planning to run for another term on city council, or are you planning to perhaps run for mayor yourself?
right now, I'm having had a council meeting. So no plans to run for mayor. A second term on the council is certainly a possibility, depending on how I feel at the time.
That's not a no.
No. You know, nobody says no. So I'm not going to sit here and play games. If the opportunity came up to run for mayor and everything was falling into place, what a great spot to leave a positive, great thumbprint on your city. What an opportunity to be an inspiration to young people. What an opportunity to set the example that we all want to look up to. And I would take that in a heartbeat, but I ran for mayor one time before and I didn't make it. So I'd be a little gun shy on trying it again, unless I could somehow raise the dollars, and that's not easy to do when you're running for mayor. Jacksonville has a way of picking its mayors, and mm-hmm. so, but at least being in the arena on an at-large basis gives me a chance to speak to all of Jacksonville's issues, and I'm trying to do that the best that I can.
Always good to have you, meanwhile, on the show, and thanks for being here this Monday morning.
Oh, it's been a blast. I appreciate it. Thank you very much.
Jacksonville City Councilman Matt Carlucci. And as I mentioned earlier, we're working to get more of the new city council reps on the show as we can book them. Up next, author Bianca Murray here on First Coast Connect. We'll be right back. Welcome back. It's a provocative new tale that's being released on the 25th anniversary of the end of apartheid and the historic election of Nelson Mandela. Author Bianca Murray looks at family bonds, the struggle for identity, and South Africa's tortured racial history in her new book, If You Want to Make God Laugh. Murray appears tomorrow night at the Bookmark in Neptune Beach. I spoke with her last week. Bianca Murray, a pleasure to have you on the show. Thanks for being with us.
Melissa, thank you so much for having me on the show.
You received such plaudits and praise for your first novel, and you followed it up with this new tale, If You Want to Make God Laugh. This is also, like your first book, set in South Africa against the backdrop of the end of apartheid, the Mandela presidency, the AIDS epidemic in that country. There's so much happening as you pull together this tale. Beauty, really, pulling beauty from the pain of South African history. How did you put this story together? Tell me about how the story came together.
Right. So I was born in South Africa and I grew up in South Africa. And in my early 30s, I started volunteering in Soweto, which is South Africa's largest urban black settlement. And this was kind of at the beginning of the onset of the AIDS pandemic. And I was volunteering there with HIV/AIDS orphans and their caregivers, and just seeing this huge missing generation starting to occur in South Africa, and seeing these elderly grandmothers having to step into the breach and raise their grandchildren because all their children were dying from the disease. And so this was like a very, very formative period of my life, and I really always wanted to write about it. It was also such an interesting time in South Africa's history, you know, the transition from apartheid to democracy, seeing how brilliantly President Nelson Mandela navigated all of that, because the country could so easily have just, you know, gone into civil war, and he prevented that from happening. So all of that, all of my personal experience served as the inspiration for this novel.
And, you know, here in the United States, of course, people know the story of the end of apartheid and they know how transformative Nelson Mandela was. But your books, I think, help people understand South Africa a little better. Was that a goal for you as well?
Definitely. You know, you can read things in the news and you can see them playing out on the international stage. But for someone to really, really understand what it was like to be there in that time, I think the best way to convey that is through fiction and through showing, you know, fictional characters responding to events as they play out. Because if you read nonfiction, if you read any kind of historic book, you know, it gives you the dry facts, etc. But it doesn't explain, you know, how people were feeling, how they were responding at the time. And South Africa was so split at that time because obviously white people thought, this is now the beginning of the Civil War. Nelson Mandela is going to encourage black people to seek revenge. And so white people were stockpiling food and water. You know, they were in a panic because they really thought this is it. And, you know, if you were a black South African who had lived through years of oppression and the cruelty of apartheid, obviously you were rejoicing. So depending on who you were in South Africa at that time, you saw the transition very, very differently. But either way, it was, you know, a fascinating time to be in the country.
And you tell the story through the eyes of three different women who come from very different backgrounds in South Africa. Tell me about these characters.
Right. So Zodwa is a 17-year-old black woman. She's Zulu. A young girl, and she lives in desperate poverty in one of South Africa's, you know, informal settlements, or as they call them in South Africa, squatter camps. You know, people are living in metal shacks. They don't have access to running water or electricity. And we meet her at a time of great crisis in her life. She's pregnant. You just know she doesn't want to be pregnant, but you don't know the circumstances of that. And her mother is very, very ill, and she's coping with that as well. And Zodwa, for me, was a composite of many of the young women that I met in Soweto during, you know, my years of volunteering there, who shared their stories with me, whose lives were so limited by their circumstances, many of which were completely out of their control. One of the other characters is Ruth. She's very interesting. She's an ex-stripper and a socialite. And when we meet her, she's also in crisis because her third husband is leaving her. And she kind of sees her life unraveling, and she's grappling with addiction issues. And then there's another woman, Delilah, who is a former nun. We know she's been excommunicated, but we're not sure why. And at the beginning of the story, she receives a letter and is told she needs to come home to deal with something that from her past that still affects her to this day. And these three women were so fascinating to write because they're all so... they're damaged. You know, life has taken so much from them. And yet the amazing part of their journey is seeing how they take back their lives through their, you know, their story arcs. And I love writing strong women characters. And each of them was so strong in different ways and overcame such very different obstacles, which I loved exploring.
It's a wonderful story. And let me ask you this, too, as a follow-up. You are from South Africa. You're white. You don't live there anymore. You now live in Toronto. Why did you decide to leave South Africa?
Leaving South Africa for my husband and I was purely from a traveling perspective. We both were those people who, you know, went to university, created debt from studying, and immediately went on to work. We weren't able to take gap years or to travel. And soon after we got married, we fell in love with traveling, decided we weren't going to have children, and so we wanted to spend all of our disposable income on traveling. But doing so from South Africa was extremely difficult. Everywhere is far. The currency wasn't very strong. So we decided to, you know, move to Toronto so we could travel from there. But my ties to South Africa are still extremely strong. I still run various initiatives in the country. I actually just recently started an Own Voices initiative, which I've named after my childhood caregiver, Eunice Ngogodo. And this is to encourage young Black South African women to be able to be empowered to tell their own stories, because I think it's so important that people get to tell their own stories. And yeah, I'm still very much involved in the South African community. My whole family's still there. So I wasn't someone who left South Africa because of political unrest or anything like that.
Well, we're so excited you'll be coming to talk about your book here in the Jacksonville area later this month. So, Bianca Murray, it's a pleasure to have you on the show. Thanks for being with
us. Thank you. Thank you so much for having me on the show, and I so look forward to the event. It's a stunning bookstore, and they always hold the most wonderful events. So I hope to see everyone there.
Joseph Lasco was the only soldier from Jacksonville's Mandarin community to be killed in battle during World War I. I'm Ben Brotmarkle, and coming up on Florida Frontiers, the weekly radio magazine of the Florida Historical Society, we'll visit the Mandarin Museum and Historical Society, where Private Lasco is being remembered. We'll discuss poet William Colin Bryant and the Grand Army of the Republic. That's Florida Frontiers, Monday evening at 6:30 on 89.9 WJCT.
Heart disease is the leading cause of death in the U.S. On the next Fresh Air, we talk about recent breakthroughs in treating and preventing heart failure with Dr. Heider Verreich, cardiologist and author of the new book, State of the Heart. We'll also talk about how the understanding of healthy blood pressure and good cholesterol is still evolving. Join us.
Today at noon on 89.9 WJCT, your community, your world.
When Slack got started, the workplace messaging platform, it was an 8-person team.
We thought, geez, this is a great way of working. This will be great for other 8-person software development teams. We never thought that we would see people at running restaurants using Slack, or hoteliers, or dental offices.
I'm Kai Rizdahl, Slack's CEO, next time on Marketplace.
This evening at 6, here on 89.9 WJCT.
Wanted, a political constituency for a billionaire who ruled out running for president and then changed his mind.
We need to break the corporate control of our government, and we need to deal with climate change on day one.
His deep pockets are paying for campaign ads everywhere. A shrewd investment or wasted money on a lost cause? Tom Steyer, next time on 1A.
Today at 10 on 89.9 WJCT.
Sports Wrap Up with Culpepper is sponsored by Black Sheep, Orsay, and Bellwether Restaurants.
Welcome back. Well, finally, this hour, the long football drought. Well, it ends this morning.
I'm a pepper, he's a pepper, she's a pepper, we're a pepper. Wouldn't you like to be a pepper too? I'm a pepper, he's a pepper.
The Jaguars are reporting to training camp. Culpepper will be there. But he's here first to tell us all about it. Good morning.
Good morning. Yeah, Jaguars players reporting this morning. Not all of them, Melissa. Right now, it's quarterbacks, the rookies and first-year players who are reporting right now. So that means that Nick Foles, Josh Allen, Juwan Taylor, and others are checking in for training camp 2019 this morning. They have to do so before noon. Wednesday, the rest of the veterans report for camp, and they'll be on the field Thursday for the first of 19 practices during training camp. There are 7 practice sessions that are open to the public this year, and you can attend for free, but you must register in advance online at Jaguars.com. The first 7 practices are open to the public. After that, your only chance to see the team is preseason games, or if you want to travel to Baltimore and see the Jaguars and Ravens work in a couple of combined practice session days leading up to the preseason opener between the Jaguars and the Ravens. As for now, everybody kind of looking and wondering, what is this team going to be like this year? Of course, 2 seasons ago, run to the AFC Championship game, looked like they're on their way to building something. Last year, things went the other way. So after free agency, I gave my prediction for the Jaguars' record to be 8-8. Some listeners and viewers and social media denizens didn't like that. Well, by the way, that's what Vegas thinks as well right now, for what it's worth. Since free agency, the Jaguars have gotten better with the drafting of Josh Allen and Juwan Taylor. But they also lost Telvin Smith for the year, so I think that's basically a push. Right now, I'm going to stick with 8-8 as a prediction, but I'll reserve the right to adjust my expectations after I see training camp in the preseason.
You'll keep those Vegas odds. Well, after last season, you know.
That would be an improvement.
It would be an improvement. Mm-hmm. It would be nice. Okay, speaking of football, you also went over to Alabama recently for SEC Media Days.
Yep, that was last week where the big topic was the future of the Florida-Georgia game in Jacksonville. For whatever reason, Kirby Smart has been more outspoken than usual this offseason, which is odd because Georgia's had the upper hand of the rivalry lately, and coaches talking about moving the game from Jacksonville usually come from the team who's getting whipped. So instead, Smart's been saying that playing the game in Jacksonville hurts Georgia's recruiting. The rankings, by the way, would suggest otherwise. They are in the top 10 just about every year. But I asked the Georgia coach to explain why moving the game from Jacksonville would make a difference in his recruiting.
There's been a lot of talk about the future of the Georgia-Florida game in Jacksonville, and a lot of the talk is centered around the impact that it has on recruiting or on-campus visits and so forth. Could you talk specifically about how you think that having that game off-campus in a neutral site has impacted your program and your recruiting efforts?
Yeah, I think anytime you look at things from a self-analysis and you say, okay, let's do quality control, how can we get better, how can we grow, how do we improve? All the things that we were talking about earlier, where we go, how do we improve at recruiting? Getting opportunities to present, put your best foot forward, to have people into your home. So you build a $63 million facility at your home location, and you want to develop relationships with kids. Every opportunity you miss to have a kid at your home is an opportunity to get better. We don't look at things from a scope of, well, we had the number 3 or number 2 or number 6 or number 10 recruiting class. That doesn't matter. We're trying to figure out how to get better. And the best way to get better is to have opportunities to present in front of those kids.
So I actually think that while he may believe that, I think some of this is posturing. Negotiations will be coming up for the next batch of games and whether they'll be played on campus or here. I just don't see the game going anywhere. But if it does, I think both schools would realize pretty quickly that not being a part of one of the only 3 major neutral site conference games in the nation is going to hurt the reputation of both programs. And by the way, it will not be well received by the Georgia boosters who live in St. Simon's Island and other spots in South Georgia.
Yeah,
or here in
them.
Jacksonville. Mm-hmm. And there are some big money boosters along the First Coast and the Golden Isles. So we'll be following this story very carefully.
Where would it go, Cole?
Well, there are 2 different sort of options. One could be that it would go on back onto campus and it would be played at the University of Georgia and the University of Florida.
Just
that's the only
alternate.
Case. Mm-hmm. That's the only case, by the way, where Kirby Smart's idea of trying to be able to showcase what their program does would help. By the way, if it were to do that, it would be every other year. So he's only getting that, you know, bang for his buck once every 2 years. The other thing is there's been some talk about how it might rotate between either campus sites or Jacksonville, maybe Atlanta as well. You could potentially do that. I just think this is such a special thing in college football. Only Oklahoma against Texas an Army against Navy has this kind of annual neutral site matchup among conference opponents and traditional rivals. It's a special thing. And anybody who's been a part of Georgia, Florida, knows just how different and special it is for fans.
So don't tamper with it, in other words.
Yeah, and I don't think it's going to move, but it is interesting that all this conversation has been coming out of the side that has been winning the games.
Yeah, that is weird. Okay, let's talk golf quickly.
Final major of the golf season, a runaway. Irishman Shane Lowry won the British Open, played in Northern Ireland for the first time in more than 60 years. Lowry won by 6 strokes over Tommy Fleetwood to win his first major. With the new golf calendar now, there won't be another major until next April when the Masters tees off. So this was all done to try to avoid competing with football. They won't have to compete much with football now because the next big tournament comes at Augusta National in April.
And meanwhile, getting back to what Cole said a minute ago, mark your calendar for Thursday for training camp if you want to register and go see the Jaguars work out and catch Cole on TV at night on Channel 4 on every Monday on this program. Thanks for being here.
Thanks, Melissa.
That's our show. Thanks for listening. Our producer is Heather Schatz. Brady Corum is directing today. And if you have questions or comments, send them to firstcoastconnect@wjct.org. On tomorrow's show, how local teens are trying to help refugees come to Florida and thrive. That's tomorrow. I'm Melissa Ross. This is First Coast Connect on 89.9. Have a great day. We'll see you tomorrow.
Support for First Coast Connect is provided by Baptist Health and the North Florida TPO.